Our next guest says the increasing wealth gap in the country is creating a sense of defeat among many Americans, but he says it's time for the nation to blow the roof off the 21st century and see the country through to a post-capitalist democracy.
Robert McChesney is with us in the studio. He's a professor of communication at the University of Illinois. His new book is called Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century: Media, Politics, and the Struggle for Post-Capitalist Democracy. Bob, thanks a lot for joining us.
Hey, it's my pleasure to be here.
Well, before we dig into the details, big picture, what do you mean, blow the roof off the 21st century?
Well, I argue that I believe that in the 21st century, we're going to go through unbelievable radical change in the world and in the United States. Whether we want to or not, it's not really an option. It's coming. And the question is whether it's going to be radical change we want or radical change we're not going to want. And the roof's getting blown off. And it's getting blown off because we have a series of fundamental crises, economic, environmental, that left to the current pattern are not going to be resolved at all satisfactorily, and they're not sustainable for very long. And so my book is an effort to understand what the problems are and to try to get a new way of thinking to deal with the great problems in front of us and the great possibilities in front of us so that we have a happy ending.
So the core of a lot of the problems, as you describe them, as I read you, is you see a fundamental conflict between democracy, representative government on the one hand, and a capitalist economy on the other. How so?
Well, it's always been a tension. It's always been a tension between the notion of political equality and economic inequality, which is what capitalism is. I mean, it's a few people who have a lot of wealth and a lot of people who don't have any. And the system has worked best when there's been less inequality, when there's been popular participation in politics. It's been its healthiest. The problems mount when you have increasing inequality, like we've had in the last 30 or 40 years, which make functional democracy almost impossible. And I think that's clearly the point we're already at in the United States. The recent studies that I cite in the book by our leading political scientists at our major universities pretty much all come to the same conclusion. If you actually study how decisions are made by the United States government and by state governments affecting foreign policy, economics, regulation, they're made by and for the very wealthiest Americans, and popular participation is virtually nil.
Well, before we get into how we get there, what would there look like? What would the good outcome of the roof being blown off the 21st century, what would it look like in terms of our government and our economic system?
Well, it would mean that the politics would be in command. We'd have democracy first and foremost. What we would do is we'd view our economy as being there to serve people, not people there to serve the economy. So we'd look at issues and say, you know, everyone should have a decent job. Everyone should have a good income. These are things that are foundational to having a good society. If our economy, as it's currently structured, can't produce that, what can we do to get us there? We'd think in terms of enhancing democracy as the guiding value rather than enhancing the privileges of those at the top of the economic system.
Well, people might respond and say, we've got a lot of examples, a lot of case studies of governments trying to manage the economy and not going very well, command economies, creating inefficiencies, that kind of thing.
Well, I couldn't agree more, but I mean, let's be clear. The government's managing this economy, too. It's just managing it on behalf of the people who are benefiting at the top. The government plays an enormous role in our economy. This is not a free market economy. The government plays an enormous role in shaping it, guiding it, subsidizing and bankrolling large firms where necessary. I think the government's going to continue to play a large role, but it ought to be playing a role that responds to the interests and needs of the people of the country democratically. It's not doing that currently. Now, in the book, I go away from the idea that we should have some picture-perfect model completely different than the status quo that we ascribe to. I'm a gradualist, actually. I think we're going to have rapid change, but I don't think we're going to have a complete flip-flop. But I think you start at areas in our economy and our society that are really troubling. For example, the United States, we spend roughly $1 trillion a year on militarism and national security, more than the rest of the world combined. And, we really don't need to. There's really no military security defensive. We have this enormous, elaborate industry that makes it so they're politically unstoppable in Washington from both sides of the aisle. But it's really not a very rational use of our resources. I would think in a democratic society, we would want to take the profit out of militarism. Right now, we have a number of industries that make a fortune by ramping up military spending constantly. If we took the profit out of it, like it was for the first 175 years of American history, I suspect there'd be a lot less pressure to endlessly increase it for no reason. And that would make us a much better society.
I want to get into another industry you've written a lot about in the past and in this new book, the media. You say that the media we have allows a very narrow range of political debate to be in the foreground. How did that happen, first of all?
Well, we only have a few
huge
minutes,
story, so, yeah.
to condense a lot. I would say that the problem with there's two great problems with American news media today. One, it barely exists anymore. We just have far fewer working reporters, far fewer resources going to journalism on a per capita basis than we've had probably in American history, certainly in the last 100 years. And it's a sharp fall from just 25 or 30 years ago. So we don't have much journalism. Then what little journalism we have that's left, that's very much overmatched, tends on political issues to let the people in power, Republican or Democrat, sort of say this is the range of legitimate debate. And the great problem we have with what little journalism we have is that it's basically reporters, stenography to people in power. Now, people in power are debating an issue like abortion rights, it gets decent coverage. If people in power are generally in agreement on an issue like the U.S. right to invade any country it wants to at any time, that's never debated. And we never debate whether we have a right to overthrow a government. This is whether we should overthrow it. You know, our right to do it is taken for granted because people in power think that's an innate right that only America has.
You lay out a debate between a media as a market, an industry on the one hand, and media, as you would like to see it, as a public good. What would media as a public good look like?
Well, I wouldn't quite frame it that way. I do call for it as public good. I say that journalism is a public good. And what I mean by that is that journalism is something society desperately needs, but the market won't produce in sufficient quality or quantity. And this is actually a founding principle of this country. Journalism is a commercially viable undertaking on its own, really only emerged in the late 19th century when advertising came along to provide the vast majority of revenues for journalism. Prior to that, in the first 75 years of American history, the framers of this country, the people who wrote the Constitution, understood that the market was insufficient to produce journalism. So we had massive postal subsidies to distribute newspapers almost for free, which made it possible to have this really wide-ranging journalism. I argue that we're at the moment now where it's no longer commercially possible to make money doing journalism. That's why firms have stopped investing in it. That's why newsrooms look like the Berlin countryside in 1945. If we're going to have journalism again, we have to have it. It's going to require public subsidy, but at the same time, policy in such a way doesn't allow the government to control the content. And I think that's the crucial policy issue we face.
In the internet era, the story goes, anyone can be a journalist. It's free to start up a blog, express your opinions, report on what's in your backyard or in the nation's capital.
Yeah, we do get on an airplane. If anyone could be an airplane pilot, we do send your kids to school, or anyone could be a teacher. You know, it takes resources to do good journalism. It takes competing people. It takes people who are accountable for beats. If we just have a volunteer journalism of people in their free time, we'll have a lot of people writing about the Badger basketball team. Probably not a lot of people going down to sit through county board meetings when toxic rules dumps. Are being ruled on and complex policies are being debated. That's when you need real journalists. And so, no, it takes resources to have great journalism. That's what's missing. That's what we have to answer.
You'd also like to see a change in the way federal regulations work when it concerns the media, whether we're talking about the internet, broadcast, you name it.
I do. In fact, at the end of the book, I have sort of three core policies I think we ought to be debating right now over the future of communication. One is policies to get journalism back. Another one that's crucial is I think we've got to look long and hard at what I call the ISP cartel, Verizon, Comcast, AT&T, that dominates cell phone and broadband access to the United States. This is a cartel. They literally divided up the market between themselves. These are not free market companies. They were created by government monopoly licenses. They own the politicians today. And as a result of their dominance over policymaking and politicians, Americans pay more for cell phones, pay more for broadband, and we get much worse service than most other nations in the world. They're really parasites. They serve no function. We've got to start talking about why do we even allow them to fleece us every month for the amount of money they do. Most Americans don't understand until they go to another country what a total ripoff we have. This is the sort of issue we ought to be talking about in our politics, but because these companies are so powerful and our system is so corrupt, it's not talked about in our society at all, except on the show.
We're talking with Bob McChesney. He's the author of the new book, Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, about the struggle to achieve what he's looking for, a post-capitalist democracy.
And we'd like to hear from you. Do you think today's media landscape serves the needs of the public? What about a democratic society? And what do you think needs to change? You can call us now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can email us at talk@wpr.org.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're talking with Bob McChesney. He's the author of Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, Media, Politics, and the Struggle for Post-Capitalist Democracy.
And you can join the conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with him that money, powerful corporations play too big a role in American politics, that the media landscape allows only a narrow range of debate on maybe either end of the spectrum? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. And do you think anything's going to change anytime soon? You can also post over at the Central Time Facebook page or email talk@WPR.org. Bob, you spend some time in the new book looking at the protests, the Act 10 labor changes here in Wisconsin state government, and connecting them to the Occupy movement around the country. You see that as a sign that there's maybe a move to change the course of the future from the ground up.
Well, I think what was striking about Madison, and I live in Madison, but I'm not teaching in Illinois, so I was not teaching that semester in 2010, four years ago, when the occupation of the Capitol and the demonstration took place. So I was able to go down there most every day and experience it. And I was in the crowd. I wasn't up in the bandstand or being a leader or anything. I was just one of the people there. And it was an extraordinary experience, I think, for everyone who was there. And it reminded me how important freedom to assemble is one of our core freedoms in the First Amendment, how it's always been understood that probably the most important right people have is to come together and peacefully get together and redress their grievances to the government. And it was an extraordinary experience because it put a lie to the very notion that most Americans were happy going along with cutbacks and this and that and sort of business as usual, that the society wasn't running right. And, it didn't win out as the protesters would have liked, but it really was a hopeless task in the short term. I mean, they didn't have the numbers, so it was really a protest, classic protest in that sense. But I don't think it was something that just people gave up, said, okay, we give up now, that was hopeless, we were wrong, the other side was right. I think it was a sign of what much more is to come. That will look like the Ozarks and the Rockies are ahead of us.
But was that a protest looking for fundamental changes, or was it like it looked to some people outside, a group, a particular class, government employees trying to protect their interests?
Well, I don't think anyone who said that actually attended the protest like I did. I think that's one of the things that most of the people who made that sort of criticism were making it from New York City at the Fox TV studios or somewhere else outside of Wisconsin. If you were there, you saw an extraordinarily heterogeneous group of people cutting across demographic lines from all walks of life, who are just concerned about the fact that the society is becoming increasingly polarized and governance is becoming increasingly corrupt, and really wanted fundamental change about it. And what was striking about being there almost every day for 6 or 8 weeks was talking to a lot of people, seeing the unbelievable signs that were made, was just, how thoughtful people were. And they actually had a chance to think about politics and social questions. They had a lot to say. They had a lot in their mind. People are normally told just to shut up and shop. And it was an exciting, exhilarating experience. And I think it tells us there's a lot more of that on the horizon.
Let's go to a caller now at 800-642-1234. We have Scott on the line in Iron River. Scott, hi.
Hi there. Good afternoon. Say, whenever I have a chance to argue politics, and I tend to be moderate, middle of the road, but argue politics with somebody who is of, of the Republican, the right-wing side, they always seem to pull out of their back pocket the left-wing media, and that the mainstream media is controlled by the left. And I'm never quite sure how to respond to that, where that's coming from and how to respond. And thanks much. I'll take my answer off the air.
Scott, thanks for the call. Bob, I think you've thought about this issue a time or two in the past.
Well, this is sort of thing that came up in the United States probably in the 1950s, 60s, or 70s. And it occurred during a brief period when professional journalism had a certain amount of autonomy from the owners. Because traditionally, the idea of left-wing media was nonsense. It was owners controlled the media, and they were generally conservative, so the media represented their viewpoints. And there was a brief period in which professional journalists tended to be more liberal than, say, the owners were at their news media. And that's when conservatives got very upset that the traditional ownership of the media didn't mean you got to dominate what the politics of the media were. And so it became a big campaign starting in the late 60s through the 70s and 80s. I think the evidence shows that it was always exaggerated, and it's especially been exaggerated recently when there's not much media left. And I think it'd be difficult for someone to look at the samplings of news media today and say we have a left-wing media in the United States, unless they have a definition of left-wing that simply is bizarro.
Go back to our callers now. Adriana in Bayfield. Adriana, hi.
Hi. Thank you for taking my call. My question is, I'm wondering what the caller thinks as far as people being able to change the political system from the ground up. I registered as a libertarian. I voted for a libertarian candidate in the last election, and I noticed one of the problems that that candidate was running into is that they can't ever get into debates. Like, states kind of limit who can get into debates, so it's just Republicans and Democrats. And I'm wondering, if people started doing their own research, would they be able to, like, kind of give momentum to these alternative candidates and maybe change the political system that way?
Well, that's a great question. That's a really important issue. We have a two-party duopoly control over politics in this country. You know, it's ironic for a country that prides itself on its loving competition. As George Carlin, the great comedian, put it, America, a love competition, you get it in most places, but you don't get it in the two places that count, telephone companies and political parties. There we have no competition. We have a duopoly. And it's dreadful for democracy. It's really indefensible. We see the results we get. We definitely need to blast open the system. I wish I could tell you there is an easy way to do it, to either get more parties or more competition so new voices get in. But it also means you'd have to get rid of the power of money in politics. They really go hand in hand. They're closely related. So I applaud you. I keep trying try to blast the system open, and I wish I could give you a happier short-term answer. But I can give you a happy long-term answer, which is that as soon as there's a crack in the edifice, there are a lot of people out there eager for different voices. The vast majority of Americans who currently don't vote, and I think a lot of them would like to participate if there was a rational reason to do so.
So what are you hoping to see to make these changes you're looking for, Bob? I mean, a rebirth of the Occupy movement, bigger and stronger, or a new interest in electoral politics, a third party, a change in one of the two parties? Where does change come from?
It's impossible to predict exactly. One of the things I talk about in the introduction of the book that I think is really important, oftentimes we get hamstrung trying to make a correct prediction of the future. And because we can't anticipate how it's going to look, we figure nothing's going to ever happen. It's one of the faults of being of humans. It's a rational response. We look at the future based on what we see in the present. We base the present on what we saw in the last 48 hours. So we can never predict the future accurately. No one predicted the Wisconsin uprising before it happened. No one predicted the civil rights movement before it happened. Nothing's ever predicted before it happened. People, after it happens, everyone said, yeah, I saw it coming. Baloney. No one saw it coming. They could have understood it would eventually happen, but no one saw it coming when it did. So it's impossible to say how it's going to happen. The one thing we do know is that the pressures that are taking place in society are not sustainable. Growing inequality, the corruption we have, we can look at historical patterns. Something's got to give. When you add in the environmental crises and the growing joblessness, I think it's a pressure cooker. What we can do as citizens in the society is try to understand these pressures, try to learn about them, try to find solutions that will be humane and democratic and just. Because if we don't have democratic involvement in answering these problems, if they're made by elites behind closed doors, the only thing we can be certain of, they won't be made in our interest.
So, I mean, on a practical level, you're calling on people to learn, come up with solutions. But what stuff do you think people would be best occupied doing to change things?
It depends on where they are in their life and what they're doing with their life. I'm a college professor. I write books and do radio shows and talk to people. I go to public groups. I think some people get involved with their church groups, or their unions, or civic organizations to raise issues and get people involved. Some people get involved in politics, and I admire all my friends I've known who've run for office. I think it is an incredibly difficult thing to do, who've worked on campaigns. Sometimes it's working on demonstrations. You know, there's a whole range of things to do, a lot of issues to get involved in. And one of the things that we've learned in my research, and I learned from going around the country, by not having a news media anymore that covers politics, and we really don't have one that does, there's very few reporters who cover it, what a lot of Americans listening to the show wouldn't realize is there are thousands, tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of Americans are actually very interested in politics. They're working on issues all the time to get money out of politics, to get rid of the corruption there. We've already got 15 or 16 states that passed resolutions calling for a constitutional amendment to take money out of politics. Most Americans don't realize that. It's further along than constitutional amendments for women's rights or a lot of the other ones were at a similar point in time. But since it's not covered, people assume no one's doing anything. There's a lot going on, and, you know, The ultimate point here is that, you know, when you look in the mirror, either you're going to do something or not. You're going to be positive or you're going to be negative. If you act like social change for the better is impossible, you guarantee it'll be impossible. Your choice is whether you're going to act like there's a hope or there isn't. And, you know, that's the one choice each of us has to make.
Bob, thanks for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That's Bob McChesney, author of the book Blowing the Roof Off the 21st Century, about the struggle to achieve what he's looking for, a post-capitalist democracy.